Welcome to Level 3 of Verbal Advantage. Let me begin by asking you an important question. Do you know the name of your dictionary? Think about it for a moment. Can you remember the full name? Here's why I ask. In the many professional workshops I've taught, I found that most people haven't the slightest idea what the name of their dictionary is. Webster's, they tell me, and I shoot back, did you know that the name Webster's is in the public domain, and there are well over a dozen dictionaries called Webster's on the market? Which Webster's do you own? Most people don't know the name of their dictionary, or who publishes it. They may know if it's old or new, but they generally don't know if it's abridged or unabridged, or what its strengths and weaknesses are. That has always struck me as strange. Would you buy a car without knowing the name of the company that made it? Or a tool without knowing how to use it? Most people agree that a dictionary is an essential resource, one that everyone should own, but they rarely take advantage of what it has to offer. The average college-educated person may use a dictionary once or twice a month. In my workshops, I found that secretaries use a dictionary once or twice a week. Their bosses, on the other hand, the managers, executives, and professionals, may crack the binding of a word book as infrequently as once or twice a year. As I'm sure you can guess by now, that spells disaster for anyone who wants to use the language with precision. Part of achieving the verbal advantage is developing what I call the dictionary habit. I can assure you, it is a beneficial addiction. No harm will come to you from using a dictionary to increase your knowledge of words. You should own at least two dictionaries. Keep one at work and one at home, and make an effort to consult them regularly. Look up any challenging words you come across in reading, especially those you think you know and have been reading around, as we discussed earlier. You should also use the dictionary when you write. Let me underscore that last point. If you write without consulting a dictionary, all sorts of embarrassing errors can slip by into the finished product. A report, proposal, or memo in which words are misused or misspelled is irritating to read, and we all know that when it comes to making the right impression, even a little irritation can damage your credibility. I once edited a book on business leadership by a prominent management consultant who has a doctoral degree. Throughout the book, the author used the phrase, a decisional criteria. Does anything about that phrase strike you as objectionable? If you're thinking, that sounds like jargon, you're right. It's an example of specialized, unnecessarily technical language. Beyond that objection, I suspect that most readers would find the phrase innocuous. Now, there's a fine word, innocuous. I-N-N-O-C-U-O-U-S. It means harmless, not producing any ill effect, as an innocuous drug or an innocuous remark. But back to the phrase, a decisional criteria. It may seem innocuous, but in fact it contains two serious errors. First, the word criteria is the plural of criterion. A criteria is wrong. You must say, this is my criterion, and these are my criteria. With a quick peek into a dictionary, the author could have corrected the mistake. In checking the definition of criterion, he also could have avoided the second blunder, redundancy. For even if the phrase were corrected to a decisional criterion, it would still be redundant. A criterion is a standard on which a judgment or decision is based. Decisional criterion repeats the idea conveyed by the meaning of criterion alone. Translate the author's words into clear and simple English, and you have the ridiculous phrase, a standard for decision-making that pertains to making decisions. So you see, writing isn't easy, and even well-educated people can make mistakes if they don't take the time to examine their diction, their choice of words, and check their usage and spelling in a dictionary. Don't delegate this task to a secretary or assistant. You will learn a great deal from editing your own writing. You will avoid the embarrassment of turning out a shoddy product. And you will save yourself the time spent rectifying things down the line. The more paperwork you have, the easier it is to overlook small but significant errors. Therefore, it's essential that you make time to revise everything you write, not just the reports and proposals, which usually get the most attention, but also your everyday letters and memoranda. Here's something helpful you can do your next day on the job. Ask a coworker whose language skills you trust to look over what you have written before it goes out the door. In asking this favor, you can offer to return it, and so begin to set up an editorial system that can wind up improving the quality of writing in the entire office or department. A second and even third pair of eyes never hurt a piece of writing. In fact, every book, before it gets bound and published, is scrutinized by at least four persons: the author, editor, copy editor, and proofreader. Even then, a few errors still may appear in the finished product. Nobody's perfect, but the more conscientious you are about checking your writing, and the more help you can get correcting it, the better off you will be. In the long run, it will pay off in many ways, from making the right impression, to satisfying clients or customers, to getting others to understand your point of view. So, now that you are going to develop the dictionary habit, the next question to resolve is, which dictionary should I use? Although every dictionary has its strengths and weaknesses, for general purposes, just about any current hardcover dictionary will do. Paperback dictionaries, which are sometimes called pocket dictionaries, have limited vocabularies and are best used for checking spelling and pronunciation. Hardcover dictionaries come in two sizes, abridged and unabridged. Unabridged dictionaries contain up to four times as many words as abridged dictionaries, but they can be bulky and cumbersome, and unless you have a large desk, they are not well suited for use at the office. However, I am adamant, and even obstinate, in my belief that every self-respecting, word-conscious person should own an unabridged dictionary because of the breadth of information it contains. The best place for one is on a table or counter in the living room or family room, where you can lay it open and thumb through it easily. There are two good unabridged dictionaries currently on the market: the Random House Dictionary of the English Language, second edition, published by Random House, and the American Heritage Dictionary, third edition, published by Houghton Mifflin. If you'd like to learn more about word histories, you may want to acquire the Oxford English Dictionary, which is available in an affordable, compact, micrographic edition. The OED, as that great work is affectionately called, focuses chiefly on the origin and development of words. In the office, most people use an abridged desktop dictionary, usually called a college or collegiate edition. Desktop dictionaries are easy to handle and contain most of the linguistic information you will need on the job. Of the many on the market today, the three most reputable are Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, 10th edition, published by Merriam-Webster, the Random House Webster's College Dictionary, published by Random House, and Webster's New World Dictionary, 3rd College Edition, published by Simon & Schuster. Now I'd like to share with you a few tips on how to read a dictionary. In other words, how to get the most out of what it contains. The dictionary is an extraordinarily detailed and comprehensive source of knowledge about language, a one-volume reference library. Not only does it define words, it also shows how they're pronounced, it explains where they came from, and it provides information on grammar, usage, and style. When you look up a word, the first thing the entry tells you is the thing people most often overlook: pronunciation. Don't skip over the pronunciation to get to the definition. The task of learning how to use a word begins with knowing how to say it right. If you have trouble deciphering some of the symbols used to indicate pronunciation, don't worry. I'll be giving you some help with that later in the program. The next thing the dictionary tells you is the part of speech, whether the word is a noun, verb, adjective, adverb, and so on. Mainly, this helps you save time finding the right entry. For example, if you look up the word level, you will find three listings for the noun, the verb, and the adjective. The part of speech label directs you quickly to the definition you need. Usually before, but sometimes after the definition, is another useful bit of information that most people, unfortunately, can't be bothered with: the etymology. That's E-T-Y-M-O-L-O-G-Y. Etymology is the history of a word, or the study of the history of words. It is often confused in pronunciation with entomology, which means the study of insects. I have heard numerous college-educated professionals say entomology when they meant etymology. You see how a little slip of the tongue can result in a serious mistake? Remember, there is no N in etymology. If you are committed to building a powerful vocabulary, you should take the time to read the etymology of each word you look up in the dictionary. At first, the foreign words will seem strange, but soon you will begin to see patterns and recognize relationships that will give you deeper insight into the language and help you decipher the meanings of unfamiliar words. For example, the combining form mal, M-A-L, comes from the Latin malus, bad, evil. In English, when mal appears in a word, it means bad, inadequate, or abnormal, as in malpractice, bad practice, maladjustment, inadequate adjustment, and malformation, abnormal formation. Once you're familiar with mal, you have a clue to help you deduce the meanings of the harder words malefactor, a bad person, evildoer, criminal. Maladroit, inadequately skilled, clumsy, awkward. And malapropos, not normal or appropriate to the situation. If vocabulary is the key to success, then etymology, word history, is the key to successfully building a large and exact vocabulary. Now let's talk about the information everyone associates with a dictionary, definition. I want to stress here that you should always read all the definitions of the word you are looking up. Most people tend to skip to the definition that fits what they have just read or written. Don't sell yourself short. Read the entire entry. A word may have 2 or 3 or even 10 different senses. Learning the other meanings of a word is like learning several new words instead of just one. While we're on the subject of definition, let me introduce you to the words denotation and connotation. The denotation of a word is its precise, explicit meaning, its dictionary definition. The connotation of a word is its implied meaning, including all the ideas, images, and emotions the word suggests. The corresponding verbs are denote and connote. In The Careful Writer, Theodore Bernstein nicely distinguishes the two words. Denote means, connote implies, writes Bernstein. To denote is to furnish a factual, exact definition. To connote embraces all the overtones, flavors, and suggestions that are not explicit in the purely minimal dictionary definitions. In short, knowing the denotation of a word helps us use it with precision and clarity. Grasping its connotation helps us use it to better effect, with greater sensitivity, wit, or power. Dictionary definitions stick chiefly to denotation. The connotation is something you'll have to wrestle with on your own. As you acquire new words and learn what they denote, take care to consider what they connote, not only to you, but to others. Two more useful features in today's dictionaries are usage notes and synonym studies. Most desk dictionaries include brief remarks on the proper and improper use of certain controversial words. If you see a usage note after a dictionary entry, be sure to read it. The advice is an invaluable part of learning how to use the language well. Be apprised, however, that the opinions given in usage notes vary from dictionary to dictionary. Some are more strict and others more permissive. If possible, compare notes in 2 or more dictionaries. And when in doubt, take the cautious route and avoid any usage that seems questionable or that you think others may find objectionable. Now, let me ask you this. Off the top of your head, can you differentiate the words gather, collect, assemble, congregate, accumulate, amass, marshal, and rally? Reading your dictionary's synonym studies will help you gain insight into the subtle differences in meaning among these and other groups of closely related words, which in turn will help you make precise distinctions in your choice of words. The last dictionary feature I'd like to bring to your attention is the supplement on style. Nearly every current desktop dictionary has one, yet most people have no idea this invaluable resource is there. Check your dictionary's table of contents to find out where these few priceless pages are hidden. The style guide explains in simple terms the rudiments of punctuation, capitalization, documentation of source material in footnotes and bibliographies, and proper forms of address. I cannot overemphasize the importance of this information. Anyone who puts pen to paper or fingers to typewriter or computer keyboard must have a solid sense of where to place commas and semicolons, how to use single and double quotation marks, and when not to capitalize. Don't be caught with your periods or commas outside your quotation marks. Consult your dictionary's style guide whenever you have the slightest doubt about the mechanics of writing. The point of all this talk about what's inside your dictionary is to impress upon you how much more you can learn from that book than simply what words mean and how they are spelled. The dictionary is there to help you at every step of your journey toward mastery of the language, so use it often and enjoy the process of discovery. And while you're exploring the dictionary, if you're confused by any of the symbols, abbreviations, or labels you come across, all you have to do is consult the explanatory notes printed in the front of the book. Now let's get back to the business of building your vocabulary.